My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may be better to carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is the other than alcoholism, we think that it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their own phone numbers in case we hope that what you learn here be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Barbara will read the preamble.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And my name is Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Izzy will read the steps.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Izzy. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Howard will read the traditions.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Howard. I'm an alcoholic. Tradition 1. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is with us. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinions on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is our spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Tonight is anniversary night. The format of the meeting will be a 10-minute speaker will speak on the ninth tradition, our information break, the main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our anniversary celebrants. Our 10-minute speaker is Bonnie.
Hi, I'm Bonnie, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm here to discuss the ninth tradition. Okay, so I'm going to read it out of the 12 and 12 in the short form. Okay. Tradition 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. And if I just picked out a couple of pieces, so if you would just indulge me for like a half a minute, because I only have 10, I want to read something from the 12 and 12 in Tradition 9 at the bottom of the last page on 175. It says, just as the aim of each AA member is personal sobriety, the aim of our services is to bring sobriety within reach of all who want it. If nobody does the group chores, if the area's telephone rings unanswered, if we do not reply to our mail, then AA, as we know, would stop. Our communication lines with those who need our help would be broken. AA has to function, but at the same time, it must avoid those dangers of great wealth, prestige, and entrenched power which necessarily tempt other societies. Though Tradition 9 at first seems to deal with a purely practical matter, in its actuality operation, it discloses a society without organizations animated only by the spirit of service and true fellowship. And I when it was asked of me to do this service, I have to say that my first, I wasn't jumping. You know, my first was like, oh, okay, of course I'll be of service. And of course I'm up here doing the ninth tradition. And so I spoke to my sponsor and, you know, she had given me some, you know, why don't we go to, you know, AA Comes of Age, which is a brief history of AA, a great book. If you have not read it, and for those of you who are new, you know, there is literature that discusses a little more in depth about the ninth tradition. And I also did The Language of the Heart. And what I'm going to speak of, as I have a couple of notes here, is that all representatives are to be guided in the spirit of service. We do not govern. And what here in the 12 and 12, it talks about Alcoholics Anonymous needs the least possible organization. But in years since, we have changed our minds. And it's the difference between the spirit of vested authority and the spirit of vested service, two concepts which are sometimes poles apart. And that's really what I'd like to discuss this evening. If we did not pay our rent, if we did not have a treasurer, and someone did not pay the rent, if someone was not here early to open the doors, if someone wasn't here to do the coffee or to buy the cookies, or if someone wasn't here for the chairperson to get a speaker, we would be showing up, and I think, in my humble opinion, there'd be a lot of chaos, you know? And, you know, when it talks about AA ought never be organized, in my humble opinion, it means that there is no president of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have a CEO, thank God. It's an outside issue, which we won't discuss. But there is no CEO, and there is no president. You know, and what that tells me is that there's no hierarchy Nobody gets to, you know, graduate. Nobody gets to, you know, as I say, be the president of AA. What we are is but humble servants. And I will talk about my first commitment ever in a different fellowship. My first commitment was a cookie commitment that I took, that I was elected, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I was newly sober. I was out of my mind. And the biggest thing was that they gave me a bit of responsibility, of which I knew nothing about. I was a 27-year-old girl who had never had an ounce of responsibility. You know, I didn't really know how to pay bills. I was always taken care of. Daddy was always there. And so I had no idea of what responsibility. And this was the first bit of responsibility I had. And I had to get there, and I had to get there early, and I had to get the cookies, and it was a big deal. And at that time, I had no job. I was kind of unemployable. So my whole day revolved around getting there and getting the cookies and doing what I needed to do. And you know what? At the beginning, that was recovery. Thank God. And thank God for my parents who were there supporting me. Thank God. Thank God. You know, and when it talks about the difference between the spirit of, you know, the vested authority and the spirit of service, I believe that, you know, this is especially, this has been my home group for the last, I think it's 11 years. I have done many different service positions here. From passing the basket to buying the cookies to chairing the Tuesday to chairing Thursday. I mean, honestly, I didn't write out all the little service. I'm on the steering committee. I believe that it's just, I'm just a trusted servant. That's it. That's it. I'm not better, I'm not less than, and I believe that every person that does service here is such a gift, and we have so many service positions here, and it is such an honor that this group, you know, really works like a well-rotating clock. I mean, we all showed up tonight, the seats were here, the cookies were there, God forbid the coffee wasn't made, there'd be a brouhaha, you know. The people who are going to have anniversary night, and congratulations to every single celebrant tonight, there'll be an anniversary cake. Someone had to go and buy that. So we're not organized, but yet we do have service committees. And we have it on different levels. We have it on the group level, and we have it on a higher group level. You know, there's general service, and we have service boards on that level, you know. And there is, you know, it's, and we get to change positions. You know, they talk about rotating. They talk about changing positions and not staying forever and ever, which is a wonderful, wonderful concept. You know, because that means that I am not the president forever. I'm only the chairperson for this meeting for a year. Thank God. Move on to something else. I did the cookie commitment for a year. Thank God. You know, and move on. And then I get the lovely idea to do another gift of opportunity, another commitment somewhere else. And that brings me the gift of growth through service. You know, and truly being a humble servant. Not because I chair the meeting, I am in charge. I God knows, I am certainly not in charge, you know. And it talks about that as the steps guide us individually, so do the traditions guide the group. And it talks about a warning here. And do I have a minute? Great, thank you. Sorry. Okay, this is from the, AA Comes of Age. It's on page 119. It talks about, unless each AA member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps of recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. Drunkenness and disinterrogation are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They are results of personal disobedience to spiritual principles. We must obey certain principles or we die. That same stern threat applies to the group itself. Unless there is appropriate conformity to AA's 12 traditions, the group, too, can deteriorate and die. So we of AA do obey spiritual principles, first because we must, and ultimately because we love the kind of love and obedience it brings. And I just thought I would end it there. Thank you very much.
Tonight, our main speaker is Dennis.
Evening, everybody. My name is Dennis. I'm an alcoholic. I was so tempted to raise my hand and say I'm visiting all the way from the Bronx. My home group is the Gun Hill Group of the Bronx, and it's really great to be here. It's great to be back with the Atlantic Group. And my friend Ron B. asked me to share a story with you about the last time I was here at the Atlantic Group. I chose not to tell this story the night I last spoke here, but I'll tell it anyway, since Ron encouraged me. You have so many service positions. I have to say, Bonnie, wherever you are, Bonnie, I really thoroughly enjoyed the ninth tradition share that you did. I love the traditions. And, of course, the steps, I'm going to talk about my recovery. But when I last spoke here, I was sitting up here. It was quite some time. It seems like it was an eternity ago. And I know about the dress code, you know, and I thought I was okay. And Ron very nervously approached me like 5 minutes before start time and said, Dennis, I don't know how to say this, but they just had a group conscience, and they don't like your pants. And I was wearing, I thought, you know, they were pressed dress jeans, but they were jeans, and jeans were unacceptable. So I said a quick serenity prayer. I was thinking, what do I do? What do I do? And he said, but that's the bad news. The good news is this guy over here, the timer, is willing to change pants with you. I don't know if he's here tonight, but that floored me. I turned to the guy and I said, you would change your pants with me? So we zipped into the men's room. I wore this guy's pants, and I had to, you know, one of my character defects among many is a streak of sarcasm and, So I didn't want to say anything sarcastic, but I had to say something. So to relieve what was going on inside of me, I said, I'm really delighted that you have so much service going on in this group. In fact, tonight you invented a new service position, group haberdasher. And I think most of the laughing, what people thought, I arrived with no tie or something. Well, I was active in service at the time, in general services, and the word spread like wildfire. Dennis changed his pants at the Atlantic Group, you know. By the time I got back to my home group, they knew about it already. So, anyway, I am impressed with the amount of service, because service kept me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and service, my life has lived on a service plane, and I didn't see how it was going to work for me, so it is a terrific thing, and I may joke about it, but I also learned to respect group consciences. In fact, Ron reminded me, he thanked me at the end of that night and for not making an issue of it, and I said, well, I didn't think I was going to change a group conscience. All I had to do was change my pants. And quite frankly, people may make remarks about Dennis' willingness to do that, but I came down here to carry the message. And what pants I was wearing wasn't important. Carrying the message was important. And it helps me stay sober carrying the message. Also, all the people celebrating tonight, anniversaries, the people counting with their days, I don't know. I got to give credit to anybody who could stand up in a crowd this large and say I got 3 days, 40 days, or whatever. I was afraid every single day that something was going to happen and I was going to pick up a drink. And I still had the shakes in early sobriety from the ravages of my active alcoholism. It didn't go away. And I knew a drink would make those shakes go away because for many years I drank over the shakes. So I remember leaving the Bronx. Most of my life centered around Westchester County at the end of my drinking. And then I got shipped to the Bronx. But I remember not wanting to be around for my 90th day. Because the last thing in the world I needed was applause. Quite frankly, the last thing I needed was to feel that I graduated or that I accomplished something. It's an important milestone, and I don't want to diminish that. So the other thing is sometimes I want to announce my day count. Today I have 6,642 days. My last drink was August 1st. AA people will clap for anything, won't they, right? So let me get into my story, and that is I'm a kid from the Bronx. And my journey was to leave the Bronx, develop alcoholism, and get shipped back to the Bronx at the end of my drinking. And now I'm a proud member of the Gun Hill Group in the Bronx. And I've had the good fortune of being around the world in different places, spoke at the International Convention as Dennis from the Bronx. And I wasn't proud to be from the Bronx most of my childhood. I was somebody that wanted to get the hell out of the Bronx. One of five kids, it was the South Bronx. It wasn't a good neighborhood. None of this had anything to do with my alcoholism. It had to do with setting up maybe some personality defects. One notable defect that I have that showed up in my childhood. And, you know, in my fourth step, this was revealed because I had completely forgotten about this. First of all, I didn't get involved in some of the street activities that some of my friends did. I was a decent kid. I was an idealist. I wanted to make something of myself. So the poverty in my youth kind of molded me into somebody that wanted to make something of myself. I remember reading the encyclopedia and wanting to be like people that had their names that accomplished great things. And And when I was 14 to 15 years old, I was on scholarship at a school down in Lower Manhattan, LaSalle Academy. And I developed appendicitis. I didn't know what it was, except I had a bad stomach ache, real bad. And I asked for help. I was shy. I didn't like to ask for help. And that's what showed up in my fourth step, right? Pride steps in. I don't want to ask for help. And finally, the pain was so excruciating, they sent me to the doctor. And they gave this kid in my class, they knew that we were buddies, $20 and said, you got to hop in a cab with Dennis, bring him to his mom. The doctor's waiting. He's going to operate at Union Hospital in the Bronx. Now, this kid lived on Lexington Avenue in 60-something Street in a townhouse. He'd thrown a party for the class already. I lived in a six-floor tenement that had roaches and rats and windows knocked out, and it was pretty bad. And I didn't want him to see where I lived. So I convinced Tom, in my best salesman-like manner, that I was perfectly okay. I stiffened up, and I said, keep the 20. Why do you want to go to the Bronx? I'll hop on the subway. And a jerk let me do it. So I felt really good about the fact that Tom would never see where I lived as I laid on the floor of the subway car and thought I was going to die. The pain got so bad. But I remember the self-satisfaction of thinking, if I die, at least Tom Keeping didn't see where I live. You know? Had nothing to do with booze. Had everything to do with my attitude, my pride, right? So anyway, alcohol entered my life in my early teen years. My dad developed alcoholism, but it was not in my youth. So it didn't, I don't know if it had a big effect. However, the drinking life was around me. My parents drank, my uncles and aunts drank. You know, there's a TV series I've been watching recently called Mad Men, about the advertising world, 1960, 1962. And everybody seems to have a drink in one hand, a cigarette in the other hand. And I admired that kind of lifestyle. That's what I wanted to grow up to be, suave, sophisticated, a drinker. But I never wanted the teenage drinking that I engaged in. I didn't like teenage drinking. I wanted to drink like a gentleman. And so although I did it, I got phony draft cards were the big thing in those days to get a sneak into bars. I engaged in some of that stuff, but it didn't get me. Alcoholism didn't develop. You know, I think I was set up for alcoholism. It does seem to run in my family. But of the five, I used to say there's only one of us, me, that got it. I have a sibling that's been having problems and a couple of detoxes. And I, for all I know, she's still out there. And I pray for her because I can't 12-step her. But I think I was set up for alcoholism. But I needed to, for me, my personality, start to drink comfortably. And for me, that happened after college. You know, I got a scholarship to college, to Manhattan College in the Bronx. And so I was a Bronx kid. I didn't leave the Bronx to go to college. And became an engineer, started a career. And then I started drinking comfortably at cocktail parties, at promotion parties, at luncheons. And at first, I was an awkward drinker. And I didn't know, you know, my dad was a beer drinker, beer and shots. You know, I used to sneak drinks. When I go to the bar illegally, I would drink beers because that's what my dad drank. But I didn't like it. I didn't particularly like the taste of beer. I fell in love with wines. You know, I started drinking different wines. I started reading labels. I kind of fancied myself this connoisseur of wines. I even started, I bought a house, married my childhood sweetheart. I had this house in Westchester. And I had this basement room I designated my wine cellar. And I had a wine rack. And I don't think I ever had more than 10 bottles of wine because I started, my consumption rather rapidly started matching or surpassing my stockpile of wine, you know? But I still had this, talk about denial. I was at a meeting this morning. We talked about denial. I fancied myself a connoisseur and I had a wine cellar. But I could see how I began to like the effect. And it wasn't until an AA meeting, when I was attending AA meetings early on, that somebody talked about the effect. And for me, it was what I identified with, a nice warm glow, some feeling that like I had arrived. I was in this bar called Harvey's Chelsea, since it's been torn down, on 18th Street and 6th Avenue. I had an office right near there. And I'd go after work. And one day I thought the bartender had turned the lights down. You know, this dimmer stuff. And it was really a beautiful place. They used to use this place to film commercials, and it really was a terrific place. I loved the saloon. And I said, you know, Jay, did you turn the lights down? And he said, no, I didn't. And it just struck me that it was the effect, looking back, it was that second or third glass of wine that I just had that all of a sudden gave that nice glow. I always had a tough time looking at myself, you know. I didn't, never, my self-image was terrible. And I remember looking in the mirror and looking at myself and sort of like doing a double take and thinking, not bad, you know. Booze did that for me. Women were prettier. I felt more at ease. The laughter came easier. You know, it talks about conviviality. It talks about joyous intimacy in a description of what alcohol gave many of us in the Big Book. And I had that effect, you know. And it was subtle. Oftentimes it wasn't dramatic. It was subtle. But it was a nice effect that I drank for. And I didn't see it because I never wanted to drink for drunkenness. I never wanted to abuse booze. I used to look down my nose at people who got in trouble. And so I never wanted to be one of those people. But, you know, in progression, what happened was I started detecting some of the signs of a problem with booze in my own life, like the thickness of tongue after you've had too much, you know, the slurring of speech, forgetting something, staggering against the wall on your way to the John or something like that. And I used to look at people and make judgments about them, and then it was starting to happen to me. So I developed the habit of, I didn't go home, I'd leave that party and go drink somewhere else. I just changed my drinking place where people wouldn't know me. I started out saying I was heading to Grand Central Station, but somehow I got detoured and a new habit entered my life. You know, this morning we were talking about denial, and the denial was, I remember my wife. I would tell you that my wife was my best friend and my soulmate. And Kathy said to me, now she's my ex-wife. Kathy said to me, I remember she said, Dennis, I don't like you. I don't like you hanging out with those people and drinking so often. Can't you come home? By this time we had our first son. And I didn't like the fact that she was picking on me hanging out. And I didn't see it as my drinking problem or drinking starting to consume my life. I saw it as she's nagging me. And the solution is, if I said I had a budget meeting, a personnel meeting, or I took somebody out for promotion, that was okay because it was job-related. So I just lied regularly. And that was kind of like the beginning of putting those denial bricks in place that built up this wall of denial around me and my drinking problem. After I was drinking about 10 years, blackouts came into my life. I started passing out. I thought I was working hard and just tired, you know. But looking back on it, one of the signs of my alcohol consumption being pretty severe was that I started passing out at parties, friends' houses, or in my own house. And I'd excuse it as tiredness. Blackouts were frightening to me. I never told a soul until I was in AA. In fact, that's one of the things about our singleness of purpose. When people talk about the alcohol-related problems that developed, man, I could identify. And when I started in AA, I didn't intend to stay in AA. I thought that I would just chill for a short while, and maybe down the road a bit I'd drink, or maybe not. But I didn't think I really had the problem that you all had until I started identifying, you know, because AA members shared about their alcohol problems. And blackouts, when I admitted that I had blackouts, I remember being so scared, and people laughed, you know. I remember my ex used to say to me, Kathy used to say, you don't remember last night, do you? And I used to think she's like stabbing me with those words. Because I didn't remember, and I couldn't bring myself to admit it, ever. I couldn't ever say, you know, I don't remember the last few hours before I hit the sack. I woke up in a hotel room in New Orleans one time. I was down there on a business junket. And I'd been with some people. They took me to a strip club. And I was the guy that I used to say I had this great job. My job was finding new and imaginative ways to spend $1 billion of the company's money on engineering projects. And so I loved these people that wanted to sell stuff would wine and dine me. So in New Orleans, they were wining and dining me. Took me to this stripper club. And next thing you know, I wake up back in my hotel room, you know, alone. But I don't remember what happened. This was my first blackout. I put pieces together, and this one guy that worked with me said that he cashed in about 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning. So when somebody said at a breakfast meeting, so Dennis, when did you turn in last night? I said, it must have been right after Tom, about 1:30 or 2 o'clock, something like that. And this guy spit out his orange juice. He was in mid-drink, and he just spit out. He said, Dennis, when I left you, it was sunrise, and you were dancing on a table with a stripper. And they all laughed. I turned beet red. I was humiliated. And I knew right then and there that I had to stop drinking white wine. I would stick with vodka. By now, my drink of choice was Stoli's vodka. And sometimes I would start with wine, switch to vodka, or what have you, after dinner drink. So I just thought, white wine probably did that, you know. But it terrified me. And then every now and then, I'd have blackouts. And I couldn't figure out the right combination of drinking and eating. I was always trying to figure out not to let them happen. Progression continued. And my ex, she had a problem of her own. I'm not going to go into her story, but she did something about a problem. I brought her into a rehab she decided to go into. And when we were signing papers and agreeing to her stay and so forth, they said, Mr. Martin, we have a bed for you too. And I thought I was like the good guy bringing her in for help, you know? And they offered me a bed in rehab. I couldn't see it. I was so offended. The next day I was in San Francisco and I called the director of this rehab. And I said, you tell your staff people never to insult me like that again, you know? I had a woman working for me about that time who joined AA. I remember I used to drink with her. In fact, the night before she hit her bottom, I dropped her off in front of her place on 14th and 5th. And the next day she didn't show up at work. And when I solicited what happened, she'd had a bad night. I'm not going to go into the details, but she had a really terrible thing happen. And she decided she was an alcoholic, joined AA. And I took her out to lunch trying to persuade her that she was ruining a career by not drinking anymore. She wasn't hanging. I guess I was people, places, and things, you know? And so I took this lady out, tried to persuade her she couldn't be a real alcoholic. And here's my argument. I said, Noreen, you can't be an alcoholic. You drink like I do. So she said, maybe you should think about that. Again, the stab, you know? Again, the stab. I said, you've seen my house. You know my family. How could you talk that way towards me? When I used to go to LaSalle, I used to cross over the Bowery. This was back in the 1960s when the Bowery was the real Bowery, right? And my idea of an alcoholic was that. And for some reason, when my dad, he got sober in 1982, that was like the denial blocked him out of the picture. I didn't see myself as that street person. And yet, fast forward, after Kathy got out of rehab, she decided that her recovery was dependent on getting rid of me. And so she got rid of me, and I fought it. After all, she'd been in rehab, so I was in court fighting for custody. I was showing up in court drunk, sleeping on a bench, almost held in contempt, paying these lawyers. They'd say, you got to show up sober. Tomorrow we're going to have a meeting about dividing assets. I remember the guy said to me, $250,000 depends on you showing up sober tomorrow. Can you do it? I said, absolutely. And before I left my place, I said, I need a drink. They'll never know. And that drink was another and another. Because by this time, I was drinking in the morning regularly. My body needed alcohol. And nothing else mattered. The judge ordered me to take a test. I walked out of the court. They almost put me in a cell. I said to my lawyer, I pay you the big bucks to take care of this stuff. You know, that was my attitude. But my world was closing in. Bottom was coming up on me fast. I'm out of the house now. The job, I had a 20-year career. They're talking to me about getting medical help. I'm talking about my divorce. Everybody else seems to be talking about my drinking. Started seeing a psychiatrist, talk about my feelings, my depression. He's talking about my drinking, to his credit. I said, can you give me some medicine, something to get these shakes? You know, then maybe I could stop drinking. He said, you need to stop drinking. You need a detox. I was taken from this place. It was July of 1990. I was in an apartment in White Plains, and I'd been fired. My children wouldn't see me. I had two sons. They wouldn't see me anymore. The wife wouldn't, she wasn't talking to me. We were in court over everything. And I came to, in my mind, alert, but my body wasn't there. I couldn't move my body. I learned after this that it was alcoholic paralysis. But I lived inside my head for some period of time thinking this is how people die, that this is what it's come to. And what I did was, I thought it was my willpower. I thought it was sheer will that I found my extremities by thinking of my hands and my legs. My body was metabolizing alcohol. Now I could say that, right? But I thought that I was finding my legs, finding my arms. I tossed my body off the couch. I was living alone in this place, and I had a little Italian family down beneath me, an old man and lady in their 80s. I'd almost set fire to the place. I banged my head up against the thing in the doorway. I was bleeding one night. And now this, I wasn't going to ask them for help. I got my body on the floor, and I squirmed like a worm. I got my body to sort of undulate in whatever way. I remember doing that. I remember thinking, this is working. I'm moving my body, right? And the whole purpose of my existence at that moment was I had a bottle of vodka in the kitchen. I had to get to the vodka. I'd become like an animal that just needed. I was conscious. I needed the vodka. And I remember manipulating the bottle like this and passing out and coming to. And I got up and thought, nobody has to know this ever happened. That was my mantra. Nobody has to know. There were a whole bunch of things happening in my life. An accident, a variety of humiliating experiences. And if nobody else saw it, nobody has to know. When I'm in court over the divorce, they asked me about my drinking. I was evaluated. And about that time, I was going home 2 o'clock in the morning, and I ran into a state trooper's car and smashed into the rear quarter panel of a state trooper's car about 2 in the morning. And I felt they were wrong for being in my way when they arrested me for drunk driving. And the alcoholism counselor that was in my evaluation also got the report of my drunk driving arrest. And he had these two things in front of him saying, well, Dennis, I guess we need to talk. And I remember claiming that he was using Gestapo tactics and walking out of there. So I was forced back to the Bronx with two plastic bags of possessions. I was brought back to my father's sober house. And my father said, son, I'm not going to watch you drink yourself to death. No drinking here. I lasted 2 or 3 days going out to various bars on a street corner of Bedford Park Boulevard. And was almost, I don't know, some guy was hitting me with a pool stick. I just have a blurred, like, gray-out memory. And the next day, it was the last day of July. I claim my sober date is August 1st, 1990. My father said, it's the street or the hospital. I said, let me think about it. And so I reluctantly decided on the hospital. And so I went to the hospital for detox. My dad, the bargain was I'd call the doctor, get me a bottle of vodka. That was my last drink, that bottle of vodka. He would tell the story about how I locked myself in the bathroom and refused to go. He got me, he took the door down and got me into detox. After detox, I figured I'd get my life together. Detox, I'm a smart guy. The impurities, the poisons are out of my system. And I heard I needed more help. The message was, you need more help. It's not just about detox. You need some kind of recovery. I heard 28 days. My ex had been to a 30-day program or 28-day program, and she stayed for like 4 months. And in any event, I reluctantly went to a drunk farm because it was a 2-week stay up in Kent, Connecticut. It's written about in the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill W. particularly liked this place. I didn't go there because I had any connection with AA. I went because it was the softer, easier way. So I went to this place for 2 weeks, and I stayed 11 weeks. What happened was the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I attended meetings with other alcoholics who shared honestly about their drinking experiences. Some had relapses, some were sober a while, some would visit. I remember meeting the guy, Maynard, whose story was in the big book, the third edition at the time, joined the tribe. At first, when I met him, I said, oh, who are all these people in AA running up to him about his story? The next time I met Maynard, I wanted to sit next to him, and I wanted to understand more about his recovery. So what was changing was me, you know, and my attitude. And while I was at High Watch, I accepted the first step in my life. I said honestly at a meeting, I think maybe I can drink. And a guy, the way he 12-stepped me was, he said, then why don't you? I'm glad he didn't come up and hug me and say, please don't drink. He said, if you think you could drink, why don't you? I made a conscious decision to evaluate my background in light of the literature, the sharing, everything. I started reading the big book. I started reading more about alcoholism, the doctor's opinion, understanding. I read some non-AA literature, trying to get a grip on this thing. And then I accepted that I'm an alcoholic. And what really terrified me was, there's two times an alcoholic drinks, right? When they plan on drinking and when they don't plan on drinking. And the latter really terrified me, because now my plan is I'm not going to drink, and I got good willpower. I'm a strong-willed guy, and that's not enough. I don't have a defense against the first drink. My will isn't going to work. So they told me the best way to get recovery in your life and avoid picking up that next first drink was to undergo a change induced by the 12-step program, join a group, get with the help of a sponsor, work on the steps. The traditions might help if you join a group. All these things started making sense to me slowly. Didn't happen in my first 90 days. Didn't happen in my first year. Happened slowly. I was blessed with a slow recovery. My children still wouldn't see me. The wife divorced me. I never got my career back. I started a new career. Last 7 years, I'm a teacher. I thought my son, he's now a lawyer, I thought he should become a teaching fellow. The next day I called about me. I was in my 50s, and they said, what's your background? I said, engineering. They said, well, we need you, you know. The first thing I did when I became a teacher was I became the coffee maker in the teacher's lounge. Next thing I did, I became the greeter for new teachers. It's not an official position. I said, nobody greeted me when I was a new guy. Let me get up there and shake the guy's hand and show him where the library is and show him where the bathrooms are. I learned to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. Put my hand out and help another person. When Bonnie talked about service committees, I remember hearing about the Manhattan Share a Day. You got this wonderful Share a Day. I attended it. And then I found out it was such a wonderful experience that Bronx had one, which led to working on the Bronx Share a Day, which then led to working on the CINI convention. And all kinds of service opportunities, which led to being invited to speak in the international convention about AA and cyberspace. Who would have thunk it, you know? I couldn't work a computer when I first got sober. I'm running out or just about out of time. All I can tell you is that my life is a good life today. And it doesn't mean it's problem-free. It means that no matter what my problems are, drinking isn't one of them. I want to end with this. I had a good friend in the General Service Office named Frank M. He was our archivist and passed away suddenly shortly after he retired. But Frank shared this prayer with me on one of my anniversaries, and I want to share it with you all. I ask for strength. I ask for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I ask for health that I might do greater things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things. I ask for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I ask for power that I might have the praise of men. I was given weakness that I might feel the need of God. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing that I asked for, but everything that I hoped for. Almost despite myself, my unspoken prayers were answered. I am among all men most richly blessed. Thank you.